We'd like to send a special thank you to our newest business member, Paradise Locker Meats, a family-run supplier of beef, pork, lamb, smoked sausages, and game meat in Tremble, Missouri. All meat cutting and processing is done on-site in their USDA-inspected plant. The Fantasma family have gained a notable reputation for providing quality meat products. They have a wide range of dedicated customers, in addition to celebrity and notable chefs throughout the U.S., receiving their product each week through Heritage Foods USA. Paradise Locker Meats and the Fantasma family look forward to serving you. For more information, visit www.paradiselockermeats.com.
This is Mario.
And this is Teresa Fantasma with Paradise Locker Meats.
And you're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
This is a special in-the-field report from heritageradionetwork.org.
When you bite into that delicious pork at Del Posto or any of the Batali restaurants, you are enjoying something created and raised in and around the Kansas City region. The Kansas City region is currently a hotbed of heritage farmers connected through local and national restaurants. They are mission-driven, but they are also hardened businessmen. When you think about heritage, you think free-range, organic, no antibiotics, etc., etc., but that's only part of the story. No one is talking about the genetics of these livestock, where they're from, their lineage, not just how they're being raised and treated on the farm. Let's meet some of these small farmers in the Kansas City region who are paying attention to genetic integrity and biodiversity in their livestock. These are also the farmers who are supplying some of our nation's best meals. Joseph Hubbard's farm is nestled in the Kansas foothills. Much of his pasture is covered with brush and trees and other woody growth. Perfect feed for the Katahdin, White Dorper, St. Croix lambs that eat their way through his farmland. Joseph raises multiple breeds of lambs for a variety of different reasons, and he's thinking about what the future holds for lamb breeding in general. No one is currently keeping data on these sheep, these goats, like other livestock, so Joseph himself is starting to keep track of his breeding decisions and successes.
I actually started when I was 8 years old. A neighbor came out and he said, "By God, Joseph needs a goat," and I started out with goats. And ever since then, we started growing. I got really big in the goats. Senior year of high school, I sold 200 goats before I went off to college. And then started getting into the hair sheep, and they're so much more parasite resistant. Just ease of lambing them. The lambs get a lot more vigor. They grow faster. And it just, for having more of them and selling volume, I had to kind of go in this direction. Now I still do have goats, but I got 650 ewes and I got 100 goats. On these hair ewes, it's more like a deer. I mean, it's up and sucking in 5 minutes. I mean, from time of birth. A goat, and I shouldn't say all goats. I have Spanish nannies that are just as good, but they just don't grow as fast. But most of the United States goats that most people are with have been babied and pampered so much that their instincts are gone. So they'll have their kids, and the kids will lay there for 30 minutes wondering what the heck just happened. And in that time, I mean, cold weather, I mean, it'll have them licked. And the moms don't have any instinct to sit there and paw at it to make it get up, make it get going, nurse. So I use Katahdins, St. Croix, and White Dorper as my predominant breeds. I like the Katahdins because of the multiple births and high growth, the White Dorper for the muscling, and the St. Croix because they have a natural tannin in their gut that wards off parasites, so you don't have to worm as much. I have two separate herds of the goats, like I said before, and my boar goat division is strictly show, and we raise a lot of wethers, and we replace nannies going to other people. So last year I was kind of going back and forth. I used to sell a lot of show goats, and then last year I kind of let it slip and didn't really do anything, so I sat down and decided, well, I either need to go big or just get out of the boar goats and go all the way to Spanish. So with the drought last year, I helped out a guy out of Texas, and he's I mean, when you go to the American Boar Goat Association register numbering system, he's number one. He started it. And I helped him out and took a bunch of ewes up for him. And in return, I ended up buying a really nice billy from him. So he got bred to all these Spanish goats. So hopefully in your Goat-tober, you will be tasting some of his offspring.
Farming is a hard business, especially for new or younger farmers. At 25 years old, Joseph is part of a new generation of farmers. Early success with 4-H projects gave Joseph the encouragement and a strong foundation to pursue raising his lamb and goats. His education, in fact his mortgage, have been funded through raising livestock, unlike many of his peers who have given up on farming as a viable career path. Joseph has had a unique experience entering the farming business, and he has a lot to say about the challenges facing the next generation of farmers.
The key to selling your livestock nowadays isn't only your livestock. Everyone has access to the same genetics if they want to. Mm-hmm. But you're selling yourself. You're selling your name. You're selling your operation. And then you're standing behind your animals. And that's how you make money.
Mm-hmm. Do you think your parents had that same concept or that same idea of selling themselves their story as well as their livestock?
Yes. They're more driven in the cattle and horses, so they go at it from a different standpoint and they have a different marketing crowd. I don't know if you've been around too many sheep and goat producers, but there could be a different, you know, there's a different type of person that raises sheep and goats in this area. Mm-hmm. You know, most people, they get 10, 15 goats, they throw them out in their weed patch behind their house and just expect them to live. No one's really going in and keeping data on them. There's no data on anything. You know, like Angus cattle, you have EPDs, you have marbling scores. You know what's inside the animal that you can't visually tell. And no one's doing that with sheep. No one's doing that with goats. So,
do you think the next generation of, you know, sheep or goat farmers will start to create those resources?
I think they'll have to. I really think if they want to be productive and move forward on it, they have to.
Well, yeah, it's interesting because we've been meeting a lot of farmers who are a generation before you, and I'm just wondering, are, you know, your peers in going back into farming as well, are you seeing a change with your generation?
You'll see a lot less, and especially in our area, you'll have there's a lot of things that make it hard for my generation to do it. I was luckily and fortunate enough from doing stuff with SAE and FFA that I had records that I was actually able to purchase my house, you know, at 22 or 23, because they need to know, you know, what's going on. You have to have tax records for 3 years to get into some of these loan processes. And as of now, I mean, stuff are starting to go through the wayside. And there's no way a kid like me can buy 800 acres for $1.5 million and find a bank that's going to stand behind you when you don't have any kind of collateral.
Right.
At the age of 16, Craig Good took care of a friend's pigs. He immediately fell in love. After graduating with a degree in animal science from Kansas State, Craig worked for a purebred swine breeder for about 5 years. In 1981, Craig and his wife Amy decided to move back to the family farm at the northern edge of the Kansas Flint Hills. Today, they run a small, diversified farm focusing on raising heritage breed hogs and 100% Angus cattle.
Did you grow up in a farming family?
When I was in high school, I have a friend that worked at Kansas State, and he was a swine specialist. And at Kansas State, he was a PhD in animal science. And he had some sows, and I'd always had 4-H pigs, just a few, you know. And he asked me, he was going on a sabbatical, and he was going to be gone for like the whole summer. And he said, would you farrow out my Chester White sows for me? And I said, well, I've never done it, but I'll sure be glad to try. And so he showed me, and I just fell in love with it. We've been here at Olsburg for 31 years, and we started up here. There's this up there at the entryway where we saw that disease control. We started up there with a little hut, and we started with about 30 pigs. And our startup of our pigs was, when we first started, my goal was to sell breeding stock. I wanted to sell boars and gilts to other producers of raising hogs. And so we did that up until about 2003. And at that particular time, the structure of the hog business changed so dramatically. As you all know, it's gone to large operations, and so consequently, if you know, most of my clients or my customers that were buying breeding stock from me went by the wayside. They couldn't survive, and the prices in 97 or 98 and 99 got down to 10 and 12 cents a pound. There was massive financial losses, and people just had to get out of the business. They couldn't stand it any longer. We were very fortunate because we're fairly diversified. We have some crops and we have cattle, so we were able to survive and we maintained our swine herd. And everybody told me at that time, they said, Craig, you're either going to have to get big or get out of the business. And it's not my personality. We didn't ever come here and move here to be a big swine producer. We wanted to do a really good job, a high quality job with smaller numbers of pigs, and to make hopefully the best pigs that we could, and that's been our goal ever since the beginning. And so since then, you know, we've been searching for ways to add value to our pigs so that we can stay in business financially as a solvent, you know, enterprise for us. But I've loved pigs. I've loved them ever since I was in 4-H back when I was 13 years old. And I, you know, some people don't like pigs, but I do. And I just, I have trouble, you know, doing anything else but the pigs. And I just think they're a great animal. We love to take care of the pigs. I like to think of it as a very good relationship, you know, between us and our pigs. And some days in all relationships, maybe I don't always do the best that I can. And there's some days that they don't hold up their end of the deal either, you know. But we it's a symbiotic relationship. They're good for us, and I think we've hopefully been good for the pigs. We try to take care of them to the best of our ability.
The Goods care deeply for their hogs. Craig's favorite farm moments are when he is surrounded by his pigs. Although there is some controversy over the use of different types of crates, Craig explained why he feels that farrowing crates are the best way to care for mother and baby pigs during a short period of their life.
We have farrowing crates, and it's been my opinion over the years that this is absolutely the best way to care for the mother and the babies during this time of their life. The sows, you can control them. Sometimes their instincts aren't, you know, natural instincts sometimes aren't the best in an AHUT situation or an outside farrowing. You know, sometimes the caretakers have to really be careful because sows get very aggressive when they have their babies. And also, in this kind of weather, I can control the environment. And we have, I guess, my opinion is that God gives us these animals as farmers to take care of them. And it's my responsibility to save everyone that I can. And it's just being responsible. But it also, financially, you can't afford to lose a lot of animals once they're born. But it's, if we know a way that we can care for animals that helps them to survive and be more healthy, then I think I'm remiss if I don't do that.
Frank Reese is considered the godfather of American poultry. This fourth-generation poultry farmer from Lindsberg, Kansas, joined 4-H and began keeping his own turkeys at about age 5. He won his very first Kansas State Turkey Championship in 1955 and his first National Turkey Championship in 1974. This is a man who knows his poultry. Frank focuses his time and energy on breeding and raising old lines of heritage turkey and chicken. His operation focuses not only on providing a comfortable environment, but also on the genetics of his birds. This is a rarity in the poultry industry. As Frank says, 90% of all suffering of animals is because of the genetics chosen. He feels strongly that consumers need to pay attention to the entire story of the poultry industry, not just the final stages.
Why, when it comes to chickens, do people only take into consideration a tiny portion of the production as having value?
Yeah.
In other words, where are the breeders? Where are the grandparents? Where are the eggs?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, some of the worst animal welfare husbandry you can imagine take place in hatcheries.
You know, when people say, you know, isn't this wonderful, we've got this free-range factory free chicken that we're selling you, but they're backing this humongous system. And you know that 80% of all of that is owned by one company worldwide, and they're in Germany. No American company owns our genetics anymore. All owned by either the Dutch or the Germans.
Frank Reese works hard to communicate the importance of genetic preservation in the poultry industry. He calls attention to more than just animal welfare issues. To garner attention, he did an experiment. He wanted to show people what happened when he raised two birds side by side in the same environment, one egg with genetically engineered genes, another from his genetically pure chickens.
I just got 100 of the, well, I brought the eggs here and hatched them because I was afraid of the disease of the factory chickens. And I hatched barred rocks, and we filmed it every week. I can show you part of the, I've got on a little camera part of the film, because I wanted people to see that it's not the antibiotics, it's not the hormones, it's not the feed. It is a genetically altered animal. And that I raised them with my barred rocks. And within 3 weeks, those factory chickens were twice as big as my barred rocks. And by the time they were 8 weeks old, the factory chickens couldn't walk, they couldn't move, and I finally gave them all away to a church. And I fed them, raised them just like my barred rocks. They genetically altered the animal. So when that baby chicken or turkey is being genetically engineered, they have literally mutated the obese gene, which then forces the pituitary in the brain to tell the thyroid...
Just to eat to, more?
No, it actually changes the animal hormonally.
Yeah.
So we know that all the chickens that are being sold, eventually what happens is that the thyroxin sees this as a massive inflammation, this huge breast. Shuts down and they become diabetics. In fact, they just had the big national meeting of the broiler breeders in Arkansas, Tyson's headquarters, and the farmers actually said, when are we going to get rid of these diabetic chickens?
So they
basically you got to feed them antibiotics, because if you don't, they won't survive.
Frank has devoted his life to genetic preservation for both his birds' health as well as our own.
The main mission of our company is genetic preservation. So every decision we make is built around how does this help preserve this bird into the future. And so I'm working with a lot of farmers on preserving some breeds, and some of these chickens you'll see up here, this is like the last of them on earth. The thing about it is that's unique to us is we buy nothing from nobody, from no factory farm system. Everything is raised here, produced here, hatched here. I know it's the only way I can have control over the finest of welfare. Mm-hmm. You know, all the Amish and the Joe Salatins and all those people, they just pick up the phone. It'd be a zillion times easier for me.
Yeah.
They just pick up the phone and order 5,000 baby chicks from the local hatchery. They bring them in, they keep them 8 weeks and kill them. And that's called great, wonderful, healthy welfare. And the thing is right now, K-State, which this just happened, but this will be really good for you guys. Dr. Beyer, finally, after 5 years, is putting together and is getting the grant to do the research to prove the nutritional difference.
Oh, good.
There's a huge difference between our turkeys and our chickens and those. And it makes no difference if they're Amish raised, free range, all natural, whatever stuff he tells you.
Yeah.
And one of the things, even Dr. Elizabeth Boyle at K-State, they've already, you know, because they're going to make this a true scientific paper, right, so that you can't dispute it. It's a 2 to 3 year project. But they've already proven that our barred rocks are 6 times higher in trace minerals, 3 times higher in omega-3s. And our barred rocks, and this is comparing them against,
you know, like Smart Chicken and Freedom Rangers, and the, you know, they didn't, mm-hmm. you know, the free range chickens. And part of it is, as Dr. Wang has shown, to get higher omega-3s and a healthy fat lipid profile, two things have to happen. One of them, the animal has to live long enough for the omega-6 to convert to omega-3. And the other thing is the muscle has to oxygenate. Mm-hmm. And if you got an animal that can barely walk,
yeah, they got to run, they got to exercise.
You got to run, jump, and fly. And the animal's got to live long enough. And to live long enough means 16, 18 weeks. And it's got to be able to run, jump, and fly. With those two things missing, you can't change the fat profile.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Even Dr. Boyle at K-State, the head of the whole meat department, you know, head of the USDA, said she couldn't believe that our chicken is perfectly balanced with fat. Where the industrial chicken, Dr. Wang said, to get the same amount of trace minerals, protein, and fats, you can eat one of our barred rocks or six industrial chickens. The old breeds like this will live a normal life.
Wow.
The chickens you buy at the grocery store, if you don't kill them, they die. They're all dead-end animals. That's how the factory industry controls the company. Mm-hmm. You know, a farmer could come get these from me, take them home, feed his family for the next 300 years. With those chickens that you bought, that they raised, cannot reproduce. That was, you know, which is brilliant if you want to control the market.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Frank is an extremely skilled breeder who has brought several varieties of poultry back from the brink of extinction. Several of his birds are actually the last of their breed in the country. When asked, he explained why his selective breeding is different from genetic engineering or GMOs.
I do selective breeding, but it's the philosophy behind what I do is different.
Mm-hmm.
I want a balanced, healthy animal that can survive.
Right, right, right.
That
right.
doesn't need antibiotics and that can live a long time. And I take into consideration for it to be able to pasture and move, still naturally mate. The industry does selective breeding with none of that a consideration. It's about two things, rate of growth and feed conversion. That's all that matters.
Mm-hmm.
And if the animal can only live 8 weeks, so what? We've got the product we need, and we've got it, and it's cheap, and it's fast. So welfare is never a consideration. Welfare only lasts as long as we got to be able to get that animal to market.
Right, right, right. Yeah.
So it's the philosophy behind selective breeding. GMO's only been around about 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
That's where you take a foreign gene, you know, like from a fish or something, and you put it in a tomato, or you take it from, you know, some other totally unrelated species, and that's genetically modifying.
Mm-hmm.
Genetic engineering has been around since about 1917. Genetic engineering was started by a group of scientists from Italy who were engineers. And their idea was, is all animals are like a machine, and you approach them as a machine, and you have to tweak through mutations what it is you want that machine to do.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want it to make more milk? Do you want it to produce more fat? Do you want it to get larger? Do you want it to get smaller?
These heritage farmers in the Kansas City region are doing something special. Deciding what kind of meat to eat can be a complicated decision. It's easy to use labels like free-range, antibiotic-free, organic, to feel good about our choices. But unless we know the whole story, we may very well be buying into the same industrialized system.
This program was produced by Leah Eden for HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Thank you so much for listening. And find all of our 30 weekly shows on HeritageRadioNetwork.org, where you can also find out how to become a member. We are a 501c3 nonprofit organization. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, iTunes, Stitcher, and Instagram.